Welcome to a deep dive, everybody. Today, we're going back to late 1960s Northern Ireland.
A fascinating and tumultuous period.
It really is. We're talking about a time and place where the fight for civil rights collided head-on with deeply rooted tensions, you know?
Absolutely.
We're going to try to unpack how a society grapples with calls for equality when, frankly, when the system seems designed to prevent it.
It's a question that resonates throughout history, doesn't it?
It really does. And we've got a ton of material to work with for this deep dive. Historical accounts, firsthand reports, political analyses, you name it. Should be interesting.
The human stories from this era are particularly compelling.
Absolutely.
Imagine a place where your religion could dictate your job prospects, your housing, even your right to vote.
It's hard to even fathom that in today's world.
That was the reality for many Catholics in Northern Ireland during the 1960s.
Okay, so let's try to step into their shoes for a moment, right? Say you're a Catholic in 1960s Northern Ireland. You're going to vote. Sounds simple enough.
Should be, right?
You would think. But then you come up against this thing called gerrymandering.
Yes. Gerrymandering. In this case, it meant manipulating electoral boundaries. The goal, to dilute Catholic voting power.
So even if Catholics turned out in droves,
their impact at the ballot box was minimized.
And it gets worse, right? Because on top of that, you had the property qualification for voting.
Which, let's be clear, was not some historical relic. It was a very deliberate barrier to keep power consolidated.
So you're telling me you need to own property to have a say in how your communities run.
That's the long and short of it. And since Catholics faced significant discrimination in housing and employment, property ownership was... well, let's just say it wasn't equally accessible.
Talk about an uphill battle. But it wasn't just the voting booths where this played out, right? It spilled over into everyday life. Take housing, for example.
Critical issue, for sure.
You'd think that social housing, housing meant to help those in need, would be, you know, fairly allocated.
You would hope. But in reality, it became a tool to, well, to reward those loyal to the Unionist establishment.
Meaning Catholics, even those in desperate situations, were often left out in the cold. Literally.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah.
It was a way to maintain control, pure and simple.
It's a vicious cycle. And as if the political and social disadvantages weren't enough, let's not forget the economic realities.
Right, because this wasn't just about abstract principles. This was about livelihoods.
Exactly. So tell me, how did the economic landscape further disadvantage the Catholic community?
Well, you had key industries often located in predominantly Protestant areas.
Yeah.
This resulted in, how should I put it, a rather stark difference in employment rates.
Meaning?
Catholics faced significantly higher unemployment, trapped in a cycle of poverty, yet another harsh reminder of their place in society.
It's against this backdrop of simmering frustration, political disenfranchisement, social inequality, economic hardship, that a movement began to take shape.
A movement sparked by a commitment to exposing the truth. Would you agree?
100%. And in 1964, this group emerges, the Campaign for Social Justice, the CSJ. Tell me more about them.
Led by Kahn and Patricia McCluskey, they were determined to document the discrimination faced by Catholics. Meticulously. They were like, what's the word? Meticulous record keepers.
Not shying away from the fact.
Not at all. And their work culminated in this powerful report, The Plain Truth.
Which laid out their findings in black and white. No sugarcoating, just straight facts.
Exactly. It was groundbreaking. But what's even more remarkable is that the CSJ were deeply committed to nonviolent resistance.
Interesting. Were they inspired by figures like Martin Luther King Jr.?
Absolutely. Yeah. The CSJ clearly drew inspiration from the American Civil Rights Movement. They recognized the power of peaceful protest.
The power of dialogue.
Precisely. And of appealing to a shared sense of justice. They understood that real, lasting change doesn't come from violence, but from changing hearts and minds.
Easier said than done, though, right? Especially when those in power have so much to lose. So how did those in power react to this, to the CSJ's message?
Well, it was a mixed bag, to be honest.
I can imagine.
While their work did garner some sympathy, they also encountered resistance, indifference, even outright hostility at times.
It's often the way, isn't it? Shining a light on injustice rarely makes you popular.
Sadly true.
Mm-hmm.
But even with those challenges, the CSJ's work was vital. It galvanized the Catholic community, giving them a voice.
And it brought international attention to what was happening.
Precisely. The CSJ set the stage for a larger, more powerful movement to emerge.
And that movement, of course, was the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, NIURA, formed in 1967. So we've got this movement, NIURA, bursting onto the scene, And things are about to get real. This is no longer just about awareness. It's about concrete change.
Right. The gloves are off. Yeah. And they had a list of demands. We're talking one man, one vote, an end to gerrymandering, fairness in housing and employment. And for good measure, they wanted to scrap the Special Powers Act,
which was basically seen as a tool to silence dissent.
Right. You got it. And what makes this even more interesting is that the rise of Nicaré didn't just challenge the government. It exposed cracks within unionism itself. Talk about a tangled web.
Definitely. You had Terrence O'Neill, the prime minister then, trying to navigate this incredibly complex situation.
O'Neill was a fascinating character. A unionist, yes, but one who saw the writing on the wall. He knew reforms were needed.
He wanted to reconcile, to find some common ground.
Exactly. But then you had someone like E.M. Paisley in the mix.
Talk about polar opposites.
Paisley was a force to be reckoned with. Charismatic, fiery, and completely against giving an inch on Catholic demands. He saw it all as a slippery slope towards a united Ireland, his worst nightmare.
So you've got O'Neill walking this tightrope, trying to appease both sides, and Paisley's out there, well, basically adding fuel to the fire.
A recipe for, shall we say, a volatile situation. And then things escalated on the ground. We can't forget the Caledon housing controversy shining a light on blatant housing discrimination.
Right. And then that infamous October 5th march in Derry, a peaceful protest.
That became a turning point. It showed the world the brutal reality for Catholics in Northern Ireland. Peaceful protesters met with such force, it shocked everyone.
Talk about a turning point. The facade crumbled and the world was watching.
O'Neill was under immense pressure to act, so he came up with a 5-point plan aimed at reform. Things like a point system for housing allocation, even a review of the Special Powers Act. But, and this is important, he dodged the one man, one vote bullet.
Which, let's be real, was a deal breaker for the civil rights movement, like putting a Band-Aid on a broken leg.
Exactly. That single omission was critical. It alienated those willing to work within the system and, at the same time, made O'Neill look weak in the eyes of his opponents.
And as if things weren't messy enough, a new player enters the game, People's Democracy. A new generation of activists, ready for action, no more waiting around.
Led by Bernadette Devlin, a force of nature. This wasn't about meticulous documentation anymore. They were done waiting for O'Neill's slow trickle of reforms.
They wanted action. And to make a statement, they decided to march from Belfast to Derry. A direct challenge to O'Neill's calls for calm. Bold move.
And it did not end well. The Burntala Bridge incident, where loyalists attacked the marchers, it was a bloodbath.
The violence was a chilling reminder of the deep sectarian hatred bubbling under the surface. All those calls for peace and reform, and then this.
And with each act of violence, the narrative was hijacked. What began as a fight for equality was now painted as a sectarian conflict, a battle for power. Us versus them.
So where does that leave O'Neill, caught in this increasingly impossible situation?
Backed into a corner, O'Neill took a gamble. He called a snap election in February 1969, hoping, praying for a clear sign from the people. Did they trust him to lead them through this storm?
A bold move. So did he get the support he was hoping for? So did the voters give O'Neill the answer he was looking for? Did he get that vote of confidence?
Well, the results were. Let's just say they were less than decisive. O'Neill's Unionist Party, they did gain some ground, but so did those dead set against his reforms. It was less a victory lap and more like, I don't know, a temporary reprieve.
He was in a tough spot. No matter what he did, it seemed like he couldn't win. So what did he do?
Facing all this pressure, O'Neill took a big step. He finally agreed to one of the civil rights movement's core demands.
He finally gave in on one man, one vote.
He did. A huge victory for the movement, and one they fought tooth and nail for. But, and there's always a but, isn't there?
There usually is. So what happened? Did it backfire?
It was almost like it was too little, too late, you know. The damage was done. That cycle of distrust, the violence, it had taken on a life of its own.
So even as he was trying to put out the fire, it felt like someone was dumping gasoline on it. What a mess.
It really was. By April 1969, just a few short months after that election, O'Neill resigned. It was like watching his vision for more just Northern Ireland crumble around him, a vision he'd fought so hard for.
It really makes you think about his legacy, doesn't it? Was he a reformer who tried to do the right thing, or was he just completely out of his depth?
It's a question that historians still debate today. But one thing's for sure. O'Neill's resignation was the end of an era. The civil rights movement had fundamentally changed the course of Northern Ireland's history. Things would never be the same.
Like trying to put toothpaste back in the tube, impossible. What they'd unleashed was just unstoppable. But looking back, did the movement actually achieve its goals? Did it work?
It's complicated. On the one hand, they shone a light on the injustice faced by Catholics in Northern Ireland. The whole world was watching. And those reforms that O'Neill finally put in place, even though many saw them as inadequate, they were a direct result of the movement's pressure. It showed what people could do.
They showed that even these deeply entrenched systems, they weren't untouchable. People could band together and demand change.
Exactly. And don't forget, they did all of this while remaining committed to nonviolence. That's incredible. They truly believed in a better future.
It's inspiring, really. But then there's the other side of it. All that violence, that deep-seated resentment, it didn't just vanish overnight.
You're right. As much as the movement achieved in terms of reforms, it also brought those deep divisions in Northern Irish society to the surface. And it ignited what we know as the Troubles, a period of intense conflict that would tragically claim thousands of lives.
It really makes you think twice about the price of progress, doesn't it? There are always going to be unintended consequences. But even in the face of all that, there's still hope, right?
Absolutely. Even with all the complexities and contradictions, the civil rights movement laid the groundwork for future peace efforts. They showed the world that talking, even when it's incredibly difficult, is the only way forward.
And their story still resonates today. It reminds us that the fight for equality, for a just world where everyone has the opportunity to thrive, it's a fight that continues.
And it's a fight that demands our attention, our courage, and our willingness to stand up for what's right, always challenging the status quo.
Well said. As we wrap up this deep dive into this pivotal period in history, I think it's important to remember this. The fight for civil rights in Northern Ireland, it wasn't just about Catholics or Protestants, Unionists or Nationalists. It was about something much bigger, something universal.
Something we can all relate to.
Exactly. It was about the fundamental right to be treated with dignity, no matter who you are, what you believe, or what you aspire to be. And that's a fight worth fighting. So let's honor the bravery of those who came before us, learn from their struggles, and never stop raising our voices against injustice.
Here's to understanding our past so we can create a better future.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thank you for joining us on this journey into the heart of the Northern Ireland civil rights movement. And until next time, keep those conversations going.